10 years ago, many of our policymakers would have said, we've taken care of aging because we've got Social Security and we've got Medicare. So we've taken care of it. And I think what, in part, these state plans are doing, and also just the, looking at sheer demographics, is causing people to say, oh, maybe we haven't taken care of it. And maybe there's more that we need to do.
This is Coming of Age, Meeting the Needs of Our Aging Population, a podcast about how we can better support our seniors. I'm your host, Donna Duncan. I am also the CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association, which represents about 70% of long-term care homes in Ontario, Canada. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Arjo. Welcome back to a new episode of Coming of Age. As populations age, it's essential for jurisdictions to work across sectors to build integrated services and supports based on the needs of their citizens. Aging well is multifaceted and requires collaboration across all sectors, including local infrastructure, transportation, housing, healthcare, social services, education, and more. In today's episode, I'm meeting with two distinguished experts on aging services and multi-sector planning to delve into how some American states are leading the way in developing and implementing integrated multi-sector plans for aging, breaking apart silos, and finding innovative solutions to support their communities. Joining us on the Coming of Age podcast is Katie Smith-Sloan, aging services expert and president and CEO of Leading Age in the United States, an agency dedicated to addressing ageism and promoting innovation in aged care. Katie is also the executive director of the Global Aging Network, bringing together leaders from more than 50 countries committed to improving the quality of life for people as they age around the world. Also joining us is Sarita Mahanti, president and CEO of the SCAN Foundation, one of the largest foundations in the United States focused on improving the quality of health and life for older adults. Sarita is one of the partners and strategists for California's multi-sector aging plan. She is also an internal medicine physician and an associate professor at the Kaiser Permanente Bernard J. Tyson School of Medicine. Together, we'll discuss how some U.S. states are building and implementing multi-sector plans for aging, such as in California, to bring everyone to the table, from local communities and the private sector, to nonprofits and labor, to align initiatives and improve services for aging communities. Let's dive in. Good day, everybody. Today's focus really is on better understanding what is multi-sector planning, what is master planning for aging. Katie, I know this is a part of your advocacy at a national level in the United States. So why don't we start off by explaining what is a master plan or multi-sector plan for aging? Sarita, perhaps you could start us off.
Sure. Well, and thank you for having me today. Really a pleasure. And you asked about what is this multi-sector plan for aging. Across the country here in the United States, it is, I'd describe it as an umbrella term. It is for what we're describing as state-led. It's multi-year planning that really aims to convene a whole variety of stakeholders to collaboratively think about and address the needs of older adults and people with disabilities. And states have various names for these plans. So you could see, you know, in California, it's called the Master Plan for Aging, which I'll reference as MPA for short. Some people call them strategic plans on aging or aging well plans, but they all have kind of the same goals. And I describe it, and I think, you know, leaders describe this as a blueprint. It is really a blueprint. And for California, it's a 10-year blueprint for state government, for local entities, for the private sector, and for philanthropy to prepare its state for the coming, all the changes demographically that are going on and continue in aging, disability, and how we advance equity.
And Katie, I understand that California wasn't the first, but there are other states who are working on these plans. And there are actually collaboratives across the U.S. where multiple states are coming together to do this better.
I think at this point, there are probably 20 states that are in some stages of development or implementation of a multi-sector plan on aging. And thanks to the support of the Cerritos Foundation and others, there is a wonderful learning collaborative where the leadership in those 20 states or so come together and share best practices. What's working, what's not working, what are the stumbling blocks? It's just a wonderful collaboration and hugely, I think, you know, in many ways essential for the success of all of these, each of these plans and all of these plans together.
And how do you define aging in this context?
You know, of course, you know, I think we think of aging and I think of aging, it's, you know, it's that process of growing older, you know, has, you know, that's associated typically with the physical, the mental, the social changes that occur from time. But aging has a broader context. You know, there's sociological, there's psychological, there's, you know, how people change their roles in society, relationships, et cetera. That really, I think, to us, aging is all ages, all stages. And California, as an example, often defines, they don't need to put a number to aging. But I think at the end of the day, when we think about the multi-sector plan for aging or master plan for aging, it's a blueprint for aging across the lifespan. That's really what aging is about. You know, you can have people in the second half of their life who are, you know, in their aging time period. You have younger generations who, you know, are thinking about their aging process. So that's how I see, or I think others are thinking about aging as we think about the MPAs, the multi-sector plans for aging.
And you used, I think, an important phrase, Sarita, aging as a process versus aging as a population. And I'm wondering, Katie, if you could speak to your thoughts on that as you think about these multi-sector plans.
You know, the World Health Organization talks about the life course and what they're, rather than pigeonholing an age, but really looking at, as Sarita said, just people across a period of years and what are the various opportunities and challenges that they face as they grow old. And I think that is very much the spirit of these multi-sector plans. And I think the beauty of it is really thinking about aging as a population rather than, you know, it's a population with lots of needs. Aging, as you know, I hardly need to tell you, is not linear, right? It's not like we go through this very, very rigid process. It's different for everybody, and it's different for everybody all the time. So as we think about the sort of a framework for supporting people as they age in our society, it needs to be multidimensional, and it needs to really take into account the life course.
We so often, for older generations, for our elder populations, think about long-term care homes. We think about a place, a destination, or we think about the overlay of what care looks like, our level of care. Sarita, in California, how have they parsed out the other elements of supporting aging within the context of communities of California? So very diverse state, very large geographically. You've got rural and urban, but also other considerations for diversity. So how is the state thinking about what those broader supports are?
I feel like California, as an example, has really been working on ensuring that these master plans are, you know, customized or supported for local communities because health is local. And so what the state has done is developed a, I would say, a framework or a blueprint, but it takes the commitment from local constituents, like the people at the on the ground, to make the work happen. So to get to your question about how does this work, given the diversity of California, there's a master plan for aging playbook that has been developed that really helps assist local governments, their communities, the private sector folks within their communities, the philanthropic organizations that may be also community-led. to help them think about how can they best build environments that really support what they're describing as age-friendly and disability-friendly. So who are those cross-sector partners? And again, it could be certainly local government, community planning folks, aging and disability advocates, other experts, could be your churches and your local community. Bringing those local regional leaders is key. That's the first piece of a successful engagement. Then the other thing that we talk about a lot is how do you make sure that you have all the right measures or metrics to plan and evaluate what your community needs. So you're customizing, supporting that those local community efforts. So there's like a list of all these kind of publicly used data and user-friendly data that you can find that to help support that. And that's something that we encourage and the state encourages local communities to do. And then the California MPA has these 5 bold goals and 23 strategies at the state level. But emphasize all the time at the local level, you have to look at what are your primary problems in that community and then focus on those, like prioritize. So it could be housing, it could be transportation. They all fall within the realms of those 5 bold goals, but it may be that this community focuses, you know, predominantly on those 3.
So it's about mobilizing communities, both at the grassroots level, but then at the upper level as well. And I guess my question for you, Katie, is how do you move government on this as you think about breaking down those normal structures of government? Because, Sarita, what I'm hearing from you is it's about a much more matrixed approach.
You know, Donna, I think the answer to that is executive leadership. I think that the leadership has to come at the top. And so as we advocate for a national multi-sector plan on aging, we're calling on the White House for a plan like this to come out of the White House, where they, the White House and executive leadership, can galvanize all of the agencies within the federal government who typically don't talk to each other. I do believe that we would be far more efficient and we would fill many more gaps if we were coordinating and planning together. But I think that can only happen if it comes out of the White House.
Donna, can I add something to that?
Yeah, please do.
I appreciate what Katie has brought up about the White House effort, and what the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, kind of articulated was that this is all of government process. This is how he described the development of the MPA in California, which every agency across the state government has to have touch points. Because like you said, everybody's doing something in aging, even if you're not the California Department of Aging. So as a result, the governor issued an executive order for this MPA that really set the stage. And I think one thing that I really appreciated just really briefly was Kim McCoy-Wade is the appointed senior advisor on aging, disability, and Alzheimer's for the office for Governor Newsom in California. And this was the first time this position was created. They actually talk about the fact that they have these cabinet level meetings and they actually say, okay, what elements of your work touch on aging? So they really try to ensure that there is this recognition that this is all in government approach.
Well, I think that does speak to the point around leadership. I know that New York has recently moved to bring in a new plan. Did they take the approach of an executive order? Are there other mechanisms that other states are using? Is it funding? Is it restructuring government? Is it legislation or other policy levers to try to motivate this to come to reality?
It's all of the above. Yeah, it really is all of the above. But I will add to that, that I think that even with executive leadership, you don't want it to go away when that leader is no longer in office. So having a executive order that continues beyond the tenure of a governor or a president is really important. And whether that happens through legislation or some other mechanism, it varies state to state. But I think that's really important because, as Sarita said, this is a 10-year look. This is not a term of a governor look.
So California is in year 4 of their 10-year plan, Sarita?
Yeah, it's embarking on its year 4, correct.
So you're year 4, mm-hmm. Still 6 years to go. We know that the baby boomers, the oldest, are approaching 80. And we know that the pressure on system infrastructure, whether it's community services, hospital services, other supports, including transportation and housing, is only going to increase. Is there a mechanism to expedite some of the plans?
Some of it is really bringing more heightened awareness of the prevailing issues that we're seeing, you know, the demographic shifts, the fact that, speaking for California, that we are seeing, continuing to see a rise in the number of unhoused among older adults disproportionately. So one of the things that I think to kind of raise attention is making it personal. Kim McCoy-Wade talks about this, like everyone has a story. And so what she describes, and I'm going to quote her, she talks about pairing data with stories to make your point stick. Every leader that you want to influence, you can do so because they often have a personal connection. You know, I don't know how many times I've heard leaders talk about, oh, I know I have a parent with dementia, or I'm caregiving for an aunt or uncle. I think that really has, you know, lends itself to really important opportunities to I would say accelerate the work. I think that's the other thing. The other thing that continues to be a really important way to accelerate progress is making sure that the stakeholders that are involved are really creating or co-creating the plan along the way. So, for example, in California, we actually have one of the parts of the executive order was to create a stakeholder advisory committee to help continue to develop the master plan for aging. And they are really committed. And then the third thing I will just say is that data. So we have a data dashboard that was developed in California with some support from philanthropy too, to help advance that. And it is really about like monitoring the progress. And what are we measuring? Are we measuring the right things to achieve success? So some of those, that's going to be some of the things that I think every state is going to need to embark on to accelerate the progress. And California is doing that right now.
Is this what you're seeing, Katie, in those other states? I know you'd mentioned there are about 20 states who are along the path.
No, I think there's a general understanding that data will drive progress. And data also influences policy. So if you can take a data-driven argument to legislators, it's much more likely to get an open ear and a willingness to engage in discussion, I think, than just anecdote. So data is absolutely essential to this, and every state has a different approach to it, but I think the California has developed a great blueprint for states in terms of this is the kind of data you would benefit from collecting, reporting on, analyzing, understanding, and sharing.
Sarita, you were talking about the caregiver. So who's going to care for the aging demographic? What are the other services and supports we're going to need? What's the infrastructure, whether that's transportation, whether that's technology and access to broadband or satellite transmission so we can use technology? But also, how do you build a workforce or replenish a workforce and start thinking about what gaps are going to need to be filled? So then you start thinking more holistically about what does a community need?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you enough how important it is. And I think this is one of the things our foundation is really helping to catalyze is how do we elevate the voices of the community, or bringing them to the table so that they have the opportunity to shape the solutions they want to see. And you know, we, as a foundation with some other foundations, commissioned an organization called Greater Good Studio. They're a human-centered design firm, and they literally went out to folks in California, rural, suburban, urban. You know, they actually went out and spoke to them about their challenges and their needs and how things are working well and how things aren't working well. I think it's starting to really inform how we do more community organizing and building community movements to address the inequities that exist in aging. Every state, every local area is going to continue to need to do to be able to have sustainable changes in the aging infrastructure.
Well, and that does speak to the opportunity where it's not just looking to government to problem solve, that there is this greater role for philanthropy, for the private sector and others. How important is the role of philanthropy in this?
Well, I think it's essential. Philanthropy is is both a partner to government, but also can do things perhaps more nimbly that government can't do. And I know the role that philanthropy is playing right now in these multi-sector plans is around data. It's also around convening, like the learning collaborative is completely underwritten by foundations that have come together to say, this is important and we could play a role here. Education, clearly, helping states, helping others understand the importance of this. And I think informing policy, I think there's a really critical role. And I just want to underscore the point Sarita made about the importance of the older person's voice in this, because I think that finally, as an aging community, if that's what we are, we've adopted the mantra of the disability community, nothing about us without us. We didn't come at that naturally, I think, but we came at it through this process. And I think it's so, so terribly important. We're not doing for, we're doing with.
It's such an important piece to make sure that we don't lose all of the voices and that it's not an older demographic or our elder population in a vacuum where, again, it's going to happen to us. Such an important pivot point. So, Sarita, what are some of the success stories?
I can speak to California maybe to start. And definitely there have been positive impacts for the MPA. We've talked about the real advancement of cross-sector relationships and building trust, you know, really focused on collaborative planning, implementation, data collection, all the aggregating of the data, you know, informing all the planning, the monitoring. I think one of the things that I can speak to just in terms of some of the work we've seen, our low income, insurance coverage in the United States is Medicaid, and because of the work around the California's MPA, heightened recognition that we needed to expanded Medicaid in California, and now as a result, we're seeing more than 330,000 undocumented older adults who are now eligible for Medicaid, which covers a lot of long term care supports and other supports in the United States. There was also just a few other examples. There was increased economic security of the poorest older adults by increasing something called the supplementary payment for people on supplemental social security income. So there's a lot of other things that have been, I think, successes as a result of the MPA. And just even the establishment of a data dashboard and tracking to be able to say how are our initiatives going is a real important progress for the state.
And certainly what we've been trying to do both in Ontario and at a national level is long-term care, seniors care is not just this ministry with the name on it. It is the seniors ministry, the Ministry of Long-Term Care. It is the Ministry of Community and Social Services. It is the Ministry of Health. It is the Ministry of Mental Health. It is the Ministry of Housing. It is the Ministry of Higher Education and Workforce Development and the Ministry of Labor, as well as the Ministry of Infrastructure and Transportation and Rural Affairs and Northern Affairs. Our most recent Minister of Long-Term Care is now the Minister of Housing. And Ontario has set up some housing targets for local governments. And the intent is to involve long-term care and new seniors housing as part of those targets. But interestingly, there are those in the media who don't see it that way. They see seniors housing or seniors care more as that place of care as opposed to what is a continuum of living. And I don't know, Katie, how you bridge that gap, because I think to the points each of you has made, it's about finding those champions and those leaders.
I would say, 10 years ago, many of our policymakers would have said, we've taken care of aging because we've got Social Security and we've got Medicare. So we've taken care of it. And I think what, in part, these state plans are doing, and also just looking at sheer demographics, is causing people to say, oh, maybe we haven't taken care of it, and maybe there's more that we need to do. I mean, I won't pretend that it's not, that it's easy. It's a slog, but it's important that we stay with it. You know, we started looking very closely at the workforce challenges in aging four or five years ago, and at that point called for an all of government solution. Because to your point, Donna, it's Department of Labor, it's Education, It's Homeland Security, it's Health, it's State Department, it's all of those, plus probably others that I hadn't even thought about, that need to come together to solve and address this workforce challenge. And then we said, well, why are we just focusing on workforce? We're really talking about an all of government approach to aging. And so that's kind of how we got to our call to our plea to the White House to begin to think about this.
It really is about all levels working together and really looking at, so what does this look like from the context of a community as opposed to one ministry or department? I think it's going to be so important for us.
You touched on something that's so critical. You know, it goes back to that comment about advancing solutions has to come from a community because it touches not only older adults, but it touches everyone. I mean, we see this day in and day out with even in the work that we did, the human-centered design work. They didn't interview just older adults. They interviewed families, children, providers. Like as a great example, an important example, you have a, let's say a millennial or somebody a little bit older who is taking care of a loved one. And they are now using some of their own resources, their financial assets to support their older one. But how are they then saving for their own aging? How are they even able to save for their own children? So definitely goes back to that intergenerational importance of this work. I mean, we have to be thinking creatively, like communities that think about intergenerational activities. You know, even though we think about loneliness and social isolation being such a critical issue with aging, especially as we're seeing more and more families not living close to one another, community is going to have to step in to help and, you know, to help support some of these folks who are otherwise living alone and in isolation.
And are you seeing more service organizations engaging? You know, we think a lot in rural communities about social service clubs, faith-based organizations. You know, part of what we're struggling with, certainly in Ontario and Canada, is a lot of the people who ran those organizations are now the people who need help. But yet, we do know that there are others who want to engage, who want to be part of a solution, but there are no mechanisms to engage them. So if someone's been part of the Rotary Club and had been a business leader and is now retired, are there mechanisms through these processes to engage former community leaders like that to help problem solve and reimagine?
So there is a lot of, I think, mobilization of community organizations to try to advance this work and bring and engaging people who are, quote, out of retirement back in to impart their wisdom and knowledge and experiences to, and even to do more advocacy to say we have these issues, we need to inform policies. I think that's some of the things I'm seeing a lot more of. Absolutely.
I think the whole spirit of this multi-sector plan is that we're pitching a really big tent. And there's room for everybody in that tent to play a role and to contribute towards really building communities that are can support people as they age.
So how do we keep those jurisdictions where they already have started moving? And what needs to be done in those jurisdictions where they haven't started yet? How can individuals start to mobilize to get some movement on pitching this tent?
Three things come to mind immediately. One of them is data, having solid data about what the issues actually are and data about the cost of inaction. So without addressing some of these issues at the community level, what is the downstream impact of that going to be? And then the third thing I think is storytelling, bringing real people's lives into the picture. What is it like to be a family caregiver in, you know, where you've got all kinds of pressures and an ecosystem that may not be very terribly supportive of a family caregiver, all of the issues around it. But I think we need to start telling stories about real people and their life situations.
Yeah, you touched on things that were top of mind for me as well, Katie. And I think the other thing that we've seen in some successful MPAs, you know, pitching this big tent here, so to speak, is finding to the best of abilities a government, like they call it the insider, is somebody who can really guide the development, you know, who has the skills, who has the relationships, kind of your champion, right, to help with that cross-sector planning. So If you can find somebody like that, that really helps tremendously. I always like, you know, so find those champions when you can. And then the other thing that I think we've learned actually, you know, with such a vast MPA in California, which is, you know, these five bold goals, 23 strategies, almost 100 initiatives, is, you know, you can't do all of it at once, right? So setting some kind of short, mid, and long-term goals in that. So for example, there are some things that are quick wins, going for those quick wins, and it's all going to support that infrastructure build that you need for aging. And then there's going to be long-term things that, you know, you need to describe. And I appreciate what Katie said. It's like, you have to also be able to demonstrate that there is going to be some return on investment by taking on these approaches. So I think some of the, that has to be in the mindset too, that you, you know, because I think initially there was all these lists of initiatives and we're like, how are we going to do all these all at once? And it was like, no, you got to break it down into short, mid, and long-term.
And it takes us right back to the beginning where we spoke about the essential ingredient is leadership. Those champions really are essential as we think about the opportunity for change. And how do we quantify what the cost of inaction is?
Well, I mean, if we just take workforce for a second, if we don't solve our workforce challenge, we know that fewer people are going to be able to access the services that they need, which will place a higher burden on family caregivers, which will place a big burden on their own financial security. And so if you look sort of the downstream impact of inaction on workforce, you can see it very clearly in America's families. So, you know, for each one of these, is there a number you can put on it? Yeah, some estimate, I suppose. But what you really want is for people to understand that there's a cost, not necessarily a dollar figure cost, but a cost to people's lives.
Human impact, those personal stories.
Yeah, exactly.
Sarita, anything?
I think the workforce example is, you know, I mean, in California, like I think across the country, you know, struggling just right now to keep up with the workforce demand. And, you know, like we're going to have this shortage of, I think the estimates are around 600,000 to up to 3.2 million paid direct care workers. You know, the impacts of that. And then I'm not even talking about the estimated almost 5 million unpaid family caregivers. So that gets into like, now you talk about younger generations, like there are going to be a lot of need of those family members or unpaid caregivers to support this growing demographic. And so you do have to project. And I think that's what a lot of people are doing is projecting. We did some analysis with NORC at the University of Chicago on this, the forgotten middle. And we found that, you know, in some estimates, you know, we know that nearly 6 out of 10 Americans are going to turning 65 this past year will require long-term care services, and they're not going to be able to pay for it. Majority will not be able to pay for that private assisted living or any kind of support. And right now, these new 65-year-old folks, they're going to incur an average of nearly $120,000 in costs for future long-term services and supports. So it's just like bringing that to kind of to the head and saying there's no way they don't have the financial means. They don't have, unless you're really rich, or the other option in the United States is you spend down your dollars and you qualify for Medicaid. So you have to liquidate your assets and then be able to qualify for that lower income insurance in the United States. Otherwise, you're in a big predicament, significant predicament. So I think just capturing that. And then that storytelling, like I said earlier, pairing that with the stories, like we all have a story of somebody we know or we ourselves know that are, I mean, like I use my example of my mom, like because she has family, we're going to support her. But if she didn't have family, I don't know what she would do. She's in that middle income category where, you know, her assets would probably diminish pretty quickly as she has more disability. So that's the challenge we face, but that we have to quantify that and just keep on beating that drum, as I say, of these stories and data.
You know, and so often that we use avoiding hospitalizations as our proxy for saving, you know, for interventions and saving money. And it's true, absolutely, that is a good proxy. It's not a good proxy for everything, but one of the issues we've been working on a lot over the years is bringing wraparound services to housing. wherever somebody lives, but making sure that there's ready access to housing, particularly if people are in multifamily housing. And, you know, this is a perfect example of silos. So we've got a housing department and a health department, and they don't see that they actually are mutually have a mutual interest in keeping older adults who live in housing safe for as long as possible, so they don't end up in the emergency room. We need to make that kind of marrying of those two policy areas normative and not just a function of being able to raise a little money here and a little money there for a couple of years. We can have a program and then it goes away. So all of that is wrapped into a multi-sector plan.
I think that's a great spot to transition to our final question for each of you. So I just want to ask you both, in your view, what is that ecosystem that people will need in order to age well?
I mean, I can start. I think, you know, that ecosystem in my, and when I visualize this, it encompasses addressing all the different aspects of what I, you know, what is well-being, you know, that it's the physical, it's the mental, it's the emotional, it's the social. And I've often described this as like the total health of individuals and communities. And so for me, you know, we can talk about physical health and all the components of that, you know, access to healthcare, preventative care, et cetera. I think that ecosystem needs to be, you know, strong and have a good infrastructure and be well supported and funded. Mental well-being, I mean, we could have a whole conversation on the needs and the emerging, growing needs, not only just for cognition, as we see with, you know, with rising rates of dementia and Alzheimer's, and but, you know, so all of those things need to be incorporated into enhanced well-being and, you know, cognitive function, emotional support. You know, I think, you know, that goes without saying, support networks, you know, so that ecosystem of, like I talked about, the isolation and making sure there's social connection and that there's an interplay between community organizations and those that are feeling lonely, and having also then the other piece is the financial security. And that to me is has to be part and parcel of the right ecosystem, you know, because economic stability is going to be important for aging well, period. And then just engagement. How do you live with purpose? Bottom line, though, I would say is that all of this has to be more coordinated. Right now, we have a lot of different efforts happening. We're going to need a better coordinated system.
Thanks, Katie.
You know, ditto all of that. I think the only thing that I would add, and it's what I really admire most about the multi-sector plan on aging in California, is the underpinning of equity, that we're really looking at every person and providing the same experience for every person. And that's a huge challenge, but it's absolutely essential for us going forward.
And to Sarita's point, so often those are the individuals who can't navigate right. The system and don't have the resources. Thank you to both of you for joining us today, for sharing your passion, your insights, your sense of hope and optimism, but your greater vision for the possibilities. And it certainly gives me hope as we think about moving these discussions forward. So thank you for your leadership, your inspiration, and for your time. And I know our listeners will really enjoy this.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so that more listeners will join our community of changemakers in seniors care. Until next time, I'm your host, Donna Duncan. Keep well. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Arjo. Arjo believes that empowering movement within healthcare environments is essential to quality care. With products and solutions that are designed to promote a safe and dignified experience through patient handling, medical beds, personal hygiene, disinfection, and the prevention of pressure injuries and venous thromboembolism, Arjo is committed to driving healthier outcomes for people facing mobility challenges. Learn more about Arjo solutions at www.arjo.ca.